Welcome to the Drama Teacher Podcast, brought to you by Theater Folk, the Drama Teacher Resource Company. I'm Lindsay Price. Hello. I hope you're well. Thanks for listening. This is episode 176, and you can find any links to this episode in the show notes, which are at theaterfolk.com/episode176. Okay, everyone, hands up. All of you, put your hands up. No. So, I have a question. How many of you have students on the autism spectrum in your classrooms? And another. How do these students react to theater? Do you believe it can impact them? Have you ever been to a sensory-friendly performance? Have you ever planned one? Okay, that was more than one question. That was a lot of questions. And I'll bet that there is a lot more hands up to the answer to that first question than anybody thinks. And yes, I can see you. I can see all of you. So we're talking theater and autism today. And we are going to get some answers to those questions and more with today's guest. So a very interesting conversation. I learned a lot. And let's get to it. Hello, everybody. I am speaking with James Leckitz. Hello, James.
Hello.
Awesome. Tell everybody where in the world you are.
Yes, I am coming to you today from Hopkins, Minnesota, which is kind of like a first-ring suburb of Minneapolis.
Ah, perfect. Sometimes I say, ask where people are, and then they say, and I'm like, well, I don't know where that is, but but this is good. Excellent. This is going to be such an interesting conversation on so many levels, I think. So James, let's start off by please tell us what your job is.
Sure. So I work for a theater company called Stages Theater Company, located in Hopkins, Minnesota. And my job is twofold. One, I'm an education associate. So I'm a theater teacher, and I work at many different schools in the West Metro of the Twin Cities. And I also am in charge of our access programming. And so that is working with ASL interpreters, getting audio describers to come to our performances, doing open captioning. But also a major portion of what I do in the access is working with our sensory-friendly and autism programming. So I run a program called CAST, which is an acting program for students on the autism spectrum. And then we have a 10 performance sensory-friendly season that we do throughout the entire year.
And I think that is, talk about making sure that theater is getting to everybody.
Yeah.
Right? And that,
right.
Yeah. And that also that I have seen it time and time in the classroom, how much theater, how those with autism, theater really helps them.
It does. And it's kind of counterintuitive. You don't think it would, right? Because it's standing in front of people. So it's nervous. And a lot of people on the spectrum have anxiety. It's right. Being able to use your voice, where a lot of people or students on the spectrum don't have that vocal flexibility. But yet they get up, they can do it. And seeing theater, it works that way. And doing theater works that way. It's incredible.
It's one of the things that, and this is one of the reasons that I definitely wanted to talk to you and have this conversation, because I know that we have so many teachers who are in inclusivity situations where they have their class, and they also have students who are on the spectrum in there as well. And some of them struggle because they want to make sure that everybody is included and not quite sure how to do that. And then also seeing just how impactful them just being in the classroom can be. So I want to start with your background. So what was your first connection to theater?
My first connection, my first play I was in, it was like maybe 10th grade, 11th grade, this is a while ago, was Taming of the Shrew. Shakespeare was my first thing. Right? And so I kind of got I got a little bit of the actor bug in me from that show. And then I was on our speech team in high school doing drama and comedy categories in that. And then it was in the art. So I'm from a really small town in northern Minnesota. It's called Virginia, Minnesota. It's on the Iron Range. And the arts aren't really big there. Football and hockey, those are the major things.
Well, it's North Bay. Lots of hockey I can totally see. And football, they want to run around. So
Exactly. And so our theater program, I'm from an area called the Quad Cities. So there's these four small towns that our drama program was all four schools coming together to get enough people to do a show because one school didn't have enough people. So our drama program was really cool because you got to meet people from all over the area, which was great. And then after I graduated from high school, I went and studied theater at Augsburg College in Minneapolis and got a theater degree. And I was working a lot with a director in college named Barbara Berlovitz, who was a founding member of Théâtre de la Jeune Lune, which is a Lecoq-based theater company based in Minneapolis. They were around for like 30 years. And I was working with her. She's like, James, you should go figure out, you're a great mover, you can do this stuff. Go figure out how do you get, like, what kind of program do you want to do after you graduate? I'm like, well, I want to learn this devising theater, this physical theater stuff. She's like, okay, go to London. There's a program at a school called LISPA, which is the London International School of Performing Arts. So I did. I basically, after I graduated from college, I applied, got in, and moved to Europe, and was there for about 2.5 years going to school, learning the Lecoq pedagogy, physical theater, clowning and miming, and got that background in my body to become a theater practitioner that way. Then when I graduated, the recession hit. So I had to move back because they weren't allowing student visas or any visas really to happen outside of the EU if you weren't an EU citizen. So I had to move back and came back to Minneapolis and started freelancing around the Twin Cities as a theater practitioner. And I also did a lot of composing, and I still do. I work as a composer a lot. And I was at a parade, believe it or not, and with a couple of friends. And a woman there named Lauren Spears. She's now Lauren Eiley Spears. She was sitting there with us. She goes, James, I need a piano player for a class. Can you be a piano player for this musical theater class? I'm like, sure, I'll do it. And it happened to be at Stages Theater Company, and that was like 5 or 6 years ago. And since then, I've been working at Stages. That's how it kind of came in.
There's your journey.
That's my journey. Yeah.
Okay. So my next question is, when did the performing bug and that aspect of theater connect to the education bug?
Sure. So I wanted to be an actor for a very long time, you know, going to college for being a theater degree, and then in grad school, you know, at LISPA, learning how to be a performer. But then when I started teaching, well, let me back up a little bit. So I wanted to be a performer, and I did perform. I performed around England and Europe a little bit and kind of got that, you know, that touring kick and realized what that was like. And I realized I am not cut out to be a performer. I'm not cut up to be an actor. This is definitely not the lifestyle that I need, that I want in my life. Still theater, yes. Let's keep on theater. I love theater, what it can do. But I'm more interested in what theater can do for people than creating theater. So I got into the education just from being, you know, an accompanist in a classroom and watching people teach theater. I'm like, oh, this is how this all works. Because I never have been on that side of theater before because I was always a student. But then realizing pedagogy and ways to teach theater and approach theater to make sure that every student gets it, because every student learns differently. Every student has to approach theater from a different perspective, or just anything. You're doing math or science. Every student has a different way of approaching it, every way of coming into it. And as a teacher, you need to figure out how to reach that student. And that's where the creativity, I think, in a lot of education comes from, is learning how to reach every student. And so from sitting in that class, and then eventually I got my own musical theater class and taking that over, I realized education coming up my strong suit and something I'm really, really passionate about. And it's from, I also have a very specific background. I can do musical theater. I can do physical theater, miming and clowning, and I can do traditional text-based work. So I can do a lot of different styles of teaching, which are great for students, because when it comes to physical theater and clowning, every pedagogical teacher I've ever had that go back to the childlike state. Well, when you're working with kids, they're already there. So kids are natural clowns and mimes without even knowing it. They just have that built inside of them.
Hey, I'm going to like segue one tiny little bit, just because we're talking about physical theater. And so often you're right that they are in their own lives. They've got that natural clown ability. But sometimes when they get on stage, it seems to float away and disappear. I'm speaking specifically of older high school students. and it's very hard to get them out of being themselves. That their physical body, the character, looks very much like them and moves very much like them. And, you know, sometimes their elbows never leave their rib cage.
Right.
How do you, as someone who has a background in clown and physical theater, how do you get those students out of their shell?
Well, yeah, it starts with the first day of class, where you need to make sure that everybody is comfortable to be there. Because clowning is specific, and that physical theater is all about meeting people where you are. And as a performer, you need to be okay with where you are at that moment. And so, working with students, you need to make sure that we can fail grandly and greatly, and it's wonderful to watch it happen, and we can laugh at each other. So it's setting up that level of comfort within the classroom on the very first day. And then, so like, I have a student right now who I an elbow hugger, with the ribs, and so her clown is based on that. I'm like, Elizabeth, you know what? This is you. Do you know you do this? Your extension is from your elbow to your fingertips. That's as far as you really open up. Let's use that. Now let's make it extreme. Let's use this as a character choice. And so let go. And now it's this hilarious part of her ability as a clown.
I love that. I think that what a great, you know what? Because it's
Yeah.
instead of seeing it as a frustration, seeing it as a character choice.
Like sitting in a chair, they can't do it. And once they that's the mission of a clown, like to do something every day, but you just can't get there. And when you do, it is the biggest, and that's when the audience that's when the audience realize, oh, we're just like that. We're just like that. Sitting in a chair can be a giant barrier to overcome for a clown. So a student, if we're working on that kind of physical theater and clowning, if their elbows are going to stay on their ribs, great. Let's use that to the best of our ability. Now let's figure out how does your spine and shoulders move? They're stuck too. So we become like this really interesting boxy character. How do you walk then? Great. Do you maybe hop? Great. Let's figure out how do we exaggerate everything to make this into a giant character that is based on your ability and where you are right now. Because then once they realize that, they're comfortable with it, and then they open up. I believe like in like 2 or 3 weeks, this girl will be like extending everything out fully alive on stage. I guarantee it.
I love it. Awesome. So let's move this into your because you also have through and you can totally correct me as I go through this. You have a program, the CAST program, where you do sensory performances, but then you're also having classes for those on the spectrum, right? Where they're
Right.
also exploring theater in a class setting.
Yep. So we have a class called CAST at Stages, and CAST is an acronym, which is Creative Accepting Sensory Friendly Theater. And that is for students who are on the spectrum. And I'll bring the physical theater back into it because I think that's why the class, how we've made it work so well, is because we use physical theater tactics inside the class. I'll come back to that in a little bit. But our class, we meet on Saturdays. And we have two groups, one that is for ages 7 to 11, and then another group that is ages 12 to 17. And so we have it for, it's an hour and a half class. A class is maxed. The most students are 8 at a session. And there's two adults in the room, so two main teachers. And then we have a student intern as well for each class. And we use theater skills and improv to help teach social skills for students on the spectrum. So it's using essentially what is theater? Theater, it's getting in front of a group of people. You're communicating ideas back and forth. You're communicating with the audience. You're saying ideas to somebody, or you're communicating them with your body. You're working together to have a goal. We're using what theater is, just to help students understand socialization, building confidence, finding their place in space, physically and metaphorically, and just using theater to help students navigate their lives. Kind of what we do, which what theater education is, right? It's using theater to help students navigate their lives. But with students on the spectrum, there's some extra barriers for them, but theater fits in naturally for that.
Well, I mean, what else is the theater classroom doing but teaching how to communicate with each other, how to work with each other, self-confidence skills? It just must take it to an extra level when you have a more of a barrier between you and the outside world.
Yeah, it does. And the classes, I was preparing like questions, like thinking to myself, how is a CAST class different from a regular class I have? And I really, to tell you the truth, I can't. Yep, it's something you can see, but I don't know how to describe it. Except for that, the class is just slower. The class just moves at a slower pace than what a regular class does, because certain students, and if you're in a regular classroom setting and students are blurting out, hey, stop blurting out because you know the rules of blurting. You raise your hand and you talk this way. There's a social decorum that students in a regular classroom or a typical classroom just know, and we expect them to know it. And if they don't, and they're choosing not to, then some gets into some sort of disciplinary action or walking down that trail of teaching. With when you're on the spectrum, students sometimes blurt out all the time because they can't keep it in. And it's not coming from a place of a mischievousness or a maliciousness. That's just who they are. And so it's being able to realize and figure out when a student's behavior is communicating something because they're on the spectrum, and when is it something that they're communicating because they are eight, and balancing out those two ideas and watching a classroom that way.
I think that's a really good point to bring up for some of our folks who are listening who are in that situation where they're in a regular classroom and they have someone on the spectrum in that classroom, that you're that there are in any classroom, and particularly in the drama classroom, there are rules and procedures, and the more structure there is in a drama classroom, the more there is room for creative chaos.
Right.
And so how can a student who is on the spectrum, who is in a theater classroom, how can a teacher help them make the most of that classroom, and what can the student do to make the most of that class?
Sure. So the way we approach it is that we make sure that students know what we are doing every day, making sure it's very clear. I've used this in all my classes now, just because it works really well as a schedule of events. So I'm talking from the teacher's perspective with students in who are on the spectrum right now, for listeners. Students on the spectrum, a lot of them have a very meticulous, they need to know exactly what is going to happen in the class so they can prepare in their mind. So they know A goes to B, B goes to C, C goes to D. Have a schedule of events going up so students know where we're starting from and where we are going to. I use this I have a conservatory class. I use it in that as well. So students are like, just because I get annoyed sometimes with my mainstream students, like, what are we doing next? When's break? When's this happening? Look at the schedule, you know? But for students on the spectrum, they will never ask what's next because they just see it and they know, boom, it's right there. I even have it down in times that there the class is scheduled out. That's one thing that's really useful. Also is having patience. Being able to work one-on-one with students on the spectrum is really useful. And it's being able to ask questions to help navigate a situation. For example, if a student is having if you think they're not paying attention because they're not looking at you or they're not taking information in a typical way, give instructions to the class, say, and you know, give time to go ahead and go work. Approach that student. Hey, did you understand everything that we're talked about? They're going to say yes, because a lot of times on the spectrum, students, they might not make that eye contact with you. That's just, you know, we kind of know that's one of the things on the spectrum, as we know in pop culture, like if students don't make eye contact with you, they might be on the spectrum. We kind of just know that. But when they are understanding everything you're saying and they're taking it in, but then it's a way of like, okay, do you understand what you need to do next? And that's where the help might need to come in, is giving them the basics. Here's the instruction for the whole group. Boom. Now walking over, did you understand what's happening? Yep. Do you know what you need to do next? You don't. Okay. So, you know, go find a partner and sit down and talk about A, B, and C. Great. There you go. Then you're just giving that extra support for each student so they know how to thrive in the classroom. And it's breaking it down to the smallest step, because asking for a partner might be a huge, huge barrier for a student.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting division in, yes, they know what you've said and understood what you've said, but that next step is, that's where...
Yeah, the how is really difficult sometimes.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome.
And I don't know, you know, I don't teach... When I teach with the autistic students, everybody in the classroom is on the spectrum, every student. And so I'm assuming it's really difficult when you have a class that is full of... neurotypical and autistic students. I'm assuming that's very difficult, especially if there's only one or two autistic students in the whole entire group. I'm assuming that's really difficult, but I think it's the same way of teaching, that you have to give yourself that time to talk with those students to make sure that they're succeeding.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I want to get back to you, and I wrote it down, your notion of physical theater tactics inside of your classroom, using physical. Yeah, see, here's the thing that I have in my head as an assumption or whatever, is that the notion of physicality with those on the spectrum is a bit of a tightrope in terms of what you can whether you can touch them or whether you can get into their physicality is something that is sometimes hard for them to do. So I'm on the edge of my seat, James. I would like to know about how you use these tactics with these students.
Right. So when you add that question of touch, I think it's good for everybody, every educator to know, especially working with students, is if you're going to touch a student, you need to ask permission first. And so with my spectrum students, when I talk to them, I'm like, I'm going to come out to you. Can I touch you to help move your body around? And if they say no, okay, then I just say, wash my body. If they say yes, then you can go ahead and do it. But always asking that permission first is needed to say, I'm going to walk close to you and touch you. Is that okay? That needs to. You need to do that. but here's how physical theater works in this classroom. A lot of times, students on the spectrum have a hard time recognizing, you know, the facial expressions. They have a hard time not realizing nonverbal cues for communication. Here's how physical theater works. Physical theater is a way of, it's acting from the outside in. That's a great, I would use that with my younger students. It's acting from the outside in is how a way to think about physical theater rather than the psychological, the inside out. You know, character memory, you know, emotional response. You create this character that we're thinking a lot. We can't see it, but we're thinking a lot. We have that film acting style. Physical theater is completely opposite, where we start with a physical character on the outside. It's a skeleton. And from that skeleton, when it moves around, that's where we find that emotional base that to connect from. So if we're starting with the character, how does an angry person look? Make that shape. There we go. So we're able to sculpt our body to show how emotions work. And then even if a student is unable to, I don't know how angry person looks, I'm like, well, look at my body. I'm going to start in actor neutral, which is a great place to always start from with working physical theater. And now I'm going to be angry. So I'm going to tense up my body. Do you see how my body is tensing? Ask them the question. See, my body's tensing. Yes, it is. Tense up your body. Okay, now relax. Now I'm going to change my posture. My shoulders are going to come up, and I'm going to keep my body tense. Do you see how that is changing? And if they say no, then yeah, you know, I help them move their body to that way. So we're making that physical approach of how our body replicates emotions, and having that be the starting point for students to create characters and stories from.
It sounds like modeling is very helpful for these students.
Oh my God. Everything, yeah, modeling all the time. And it's great with students who are not as committed to their autism, if they can model as well. It's great having, you know, a teacher do it, but having a student in the class help is great. Also, if you're able to have peer mentors in your classroom as well, working as another student who is, you know, as he was neurotypical, having a neurotypical student in the classroom helping model, it achieves so much more than just having a teacher or two adults in the classroom. Having that peer in the room is a great way of getting things through, because when you turn like 19, there's like this level of like teenageness that just every person gets cut off, and we no longer speak the language. And so like there's teenagers have this like weird way of communicating without doing anything, that they just get each other. I'm like, great. I thought I just did the same thing, but no, you're teenagers, you get it. So that modeling is very, very, very important. Also, when it comes to improvisation, modeling is a great way of doing it, because they might not understand how, like, you mean you make it up on the spot? Well, I'm making up the story, and they might be making it up in their head. Nope, let's talk about it, though. So use those words. So figuring out how to, you have to model everything with the autism community.
No, that's an excellent, that's a really excellent point. I noticed that you also do playwriting with your students.
Yeah.
And how does that, how does that go? Is it successful?
It's a lot of stuff. So we break down cast. It's three 9-week sessions throughout the year. So our first one, we spend on improvisation and learning, like, you know, how to improvise. Session two is based on devising, where we which the playwriting comes into play. And then number three, or the third term, is based on script and text work. So when we get to the devising section and the creating of stories, we really talk about the building blocks of storytelling, which a lot of kids, they'll know from school. You know, you have the who, what, when, where, why, beginning, middle, climax, end. They understand that stuff. But then we have to actually put it in practice. And so we do it. And this is the crazy part. It's always so exciting with students, because we never say, we're all going to be, you know, pirates in the story, and it's about, you know, finding buried treasure. Absolutely not. We could be finding buried treasure, but you know, you're going to be Mario because you want to be Mario, you're going to be the guy from Five Nights at Freddy. We have SpongeBob, we have Superman, and we have Belle from Beauty and the Beast. Yep. And they're all going to go find buried treasure. Okay, let's figure out how does that story work? And that's where the creativeness of students comes into play, that childlike mentality of that imagination, where everything just starts getting creative. We start from the beginning. How do we introduce the characters? Which happens at every single story. So we introduce characters together, figuring out the story. We develop that conflict. What's the problem going to be? Then we go into, you know, fleshing out that problem. And it's all created by the students, where we sit down, we write ideas, we try it on our feet. Does that work, you guys? We need to tweak it? Well, okay, let's tweak it. Come back down, write ideas. Let's try that one up on our feet now. So we go back and forth. It's a slow process. Believe me, you mean it is 7-8 weeks of the 9-week session just developing the story. So that last class, sometimes this is our first time we run through before we show it to our parents.
I find in a standard classroom, the playwriting is one of the things that really terrifies students. How do students on the spectrum approach playwriting? Are they scared, or do they dive in?
My students really dive in. Yeah. And I think the part that's terrifying to them is that all of their ideas can't happen at once.
Really? Oh, so yeah. it's a kind of a rush of ideas. That gets them, and that gets it. It's hard to. I'm making gestures with my hands, which you cannot see, and no one listening can see.
Oh my God, you should have seen me for this entire time. My gosh, things are off the shelves in this room. I mean,
that is a really fascinating point to sort of make, if it's too many ideas at once, is that something that frustrates them?
It is, because also I think what's great about this class and working with autism students, when they're just, you know, it's a small group, we have 8, and they're in a group together, they're told no so many times throughout their day in their lives, and we're saying, what story do you want to create? Boom, they just have so many ideas because they're just told, yes, we can do this. And they go. And every student, 8 of them, has a completely different idea. And so it's like, yes, I love your idea. I love this idea. I love this idea. I love this idea. How do we get them together? Ooh, yep, let's figure that out. And that's when the struggles of autism comes again, right? Of learning how to work as a team. How, yep, that idea is wonderful and you created it, but it doesn't make sense with these other ideas. So we have to let that one idea go. Yeah, but I know it's your idea, but we have to let it go for the story. It's not it's a bad idea or you're a bad person. It just doesn't work for our story. So using that communication, that's when the working with the autism community comes in, is after all the ideas are shared, how do we work together to make it happen? And that's where it gets really difficult, because it's their ideas and they're told yes and they never get a chance to say yes.
Oh, yeah, I know. And you want to say yes. You want to say yes.
Oh, my God. I know. Yeah, well, like we once had the story where there was they were taking a tour of the White House, all these characters were, and they went into the lamp room because, you know, there was a lamp room at the White House, but it was so boring and they broke everything. And they went to like this other room, but the room that was the best was the cheese curd, chicken nugget and ice cream room at the White House.
That was the best place to be. Of course.
Right? And then they were given a special mission to go build Wi-Fi towers in the Grand Canyon. Of course, it makes so much sense. Yes, it makes sense. Let's do that. So that was our story.
Of course it is. And like, well, what else would be the most favorite room in the White House? Okay. So before we end, I want you to just say, because I wanted to kind of provide a little idea for people about what a sensory friendly performance means. How does a show change, or what does that mean for those watching and those performing?
Yeah. I can tell you how we do it here, because
yes.
I know
yes,
every
yes,
theater
yes.
has their own different way, but I'll tell you how we do it here at Stages.
Of course.
So we do, it's every show in our main stage season and our studio season. But the way that it works is that for that performance, we limit the audience to 100 people. In our main stage, it's about 750, something like that, but 700 people can be in our main stage theater. But we close out the balcony and we only allow 100 people, so students can move around if they want to during the performance. We don't have it's general seating. So students can sit anywhere. They can sit as close to the stage as they want to. They can sit as far away as they want to. Anything is perfect for them, whatever they want to do. We call our sensory friendly shush free. So the only people that can shush a student in our performances are the parents. The ushers can't. Nobody can. Only the parents. And we tell the parents too, it's the shush free. They can experience it however they want to. If they want to sing along with the actors to the songs, great, sing along. If they want to, if they're making their nonverbal sounds, great. You don't need to shush them for anything. For the performance itself, we lower the light levels and the sound levels so things aren't as jarring. And if there's strobe lights, we take them out. If there's a lot of big kabooms and the sound, we take those out or we lower it down. We keep our house lights on so the actors can, or the audience can see all around them. And that also helps with the light levels. We like to have our shows for Sensory Friendly be between like 50 to 55 minutes. And that seems to be a great length. If it's too short, I mean, it's too short, and they'll tell you. Believe me, the students will tell you. But if it's too long, it's not successful for the students because they can't sit for that long sometimes. And then it's also not good for the actors because they can feel that energy on stage and the show kind of suffers. So we like to keep it, you know, between 50 and 55 minutes. And then we have a whole bunch of prep for coming to the theater where we have theater guides. One is about the show where we have photos of the show. So it's a plot outline, talking about some of the things that might be tricky to understand. So for example, if a character is a frog in a play and they're wearing overalls and a green shirt, a swim cap with goggles on their head, they're not gonna go swimming in overalls. They're actually a frog. And so we explain some of the things that might be hard for the imagination to use. And it also just tells the story. Then we have a guide of coming to stages, that this is where you park. This is what the theater looks like. When you come in, you can get your tickets here. This is what ushers are wearing, these purple vests. You can hand your ticket and you know where the bathrooms are. So we have those guys. We also have fidgets and sound canceling headphones if those are needed. And then we have a quiet space. In case students need to get up and leave, they can go to a quiet space and there's activities that are like coloring sheets or we have more fidgets and that kind of stuff they can use there. And that is how a Sensory Friendly is different from a regular performance. It seems like a lot of work, and it is. Believe me, it is to get things started. It's a lot of work to get Sensory Friendly going because you have to talk to your actors too, and that's a huge thing of talking with actors about this is what's going to happen today. This is a show because a lot of actors aren't used to performing while seeing the entire audience. Well, they can now. And so a lot of actors aren't used to also being able having an audience be so loud. But you know, we work in children's theater and TYA here, so our audiences are always loud during school day matinee, so I think our actors, they might be used to that. But, you know, if you're not working in a TYA situation with a lot of students' audiences, it might be awkward to have such a vocal audience coming back and forth, having that talk back with you. But it's a lot of work getting it figured out. But now we're in our fourth season of Sensory Friendly, and we're starting to get a nice routine going. And there's not a lot of Sensory Friendly theater going on in the Twin Cities. There's we do it in a couple other companies, but this past, I think what we've done three performances. Adults with autism are coming to our theater, even though we're a TYA company, we do theater for young audiences. Adults are coming in because they can see theater now. They can sit through performance and actually experience theater because it is made for them, which is kind of cool.
Well, as I'm listening to this, my very first thought is how frustrating it must be to go to a standard theater for them. That the world is telling them to shush. Mm. The world is telling them not to move. It's too dark. It's too loud. And of course, they would respond in a way that the rest of the world would see as disruptive. And they're just frustrated.
Right. And I think the biggest thing about Sensory Friendly is it's not about we're doing it for our company because it's a great thing for our company to do. No, you're doing it for an audience that has to experience theater in a certain way. It's not because you're crossing off this box that we're doing Sensory Friendly. It's another access thing. Absolutely not. You can't do it for that reason. You can't. It's because theater for certain members of our audience have to experience in a certain way because it's too overwhelming otherwise. This is a way of making theater for everybody.
Yeah. Well, and the question you have to ask yourself is who is your theater for? If your theater is for your actors in your company, you know, well, A, that's wrong, but B, you know, that's fine, you know, for your pretty production, but it's for your audience. And if you have a sector of audience who needs a different experience, why not?
Exactly, then do it. And the best way for people out there who are trying to figure it out, partner with an autism organization in your community. Get those resources and they you know, if they don't know how to do it, brainstorm together, you know, or, you know, contact me as well. Go ahead and contact me if your community wants to figure out, we want to get this stuff going, you know, email me on our stage's webpage and my email is, you know, it's there. So talk to me about it too, but partner with that organization within your community to figure out how do we want to go about doing this. Are there people in our community, in the community that we don't even know yet? We don't know have an autism community. Are there people out there who would like to see theater? How do we figure out doing this? Work together. You have to do it with a partner organization. I think that's the biggest way to find that audience and get the audience and understand the audience. And then from there, you can keep on going. We partnered when we started this with two different autism organizations in our community. And it's a slow go. Like our audiences, we cap at 100, but most of our audiences are at 50 to 60. You know, except for our holiday shows, which are always big because, I mean, it's a holiday show. Holiday shows are always big. But, you know, most of our audiences are 50 and 60 students and with their parents, too, because we're, you know, TYA. So that's what we have. And so you might be losing money on it, but it's figuring out what does the audience need and can we serve that audience? Yeah, we need to. Awesome. We need to. It's hard. It's difficult, but we need to figure out how to serve them.
I love it. I'm going to put in some as well as information on Stages Theater and your program in our show notes. I'm also going to put in some autism resources as well. And James, our time is up. It just flew by. And
it did.
Thank you so much for talking to me today and sharing your experience with this type of theater. And I think as we end here, that's the whole notion of who is theater for and what can we do to make theater accessible to everyone. Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, James. So I just wanted to mention that there are a number of links in the show notes this week for this conversation. If you want to learn more about James's program, there's a link to CAST, Creative Accepting Sensory Theater. And where do you find all these links? All you have to do is go to the show notes, theaterfolk.com/episode176. Before we go, let's do some Theater Folk news. So, as I've been saying, as we've been going along into the new year, we've changed our tagline around here. We are now the Drama Teacher Podcast, and we are Theater Folk, the Drama Teacher Resource Company. That means I have to say drama a lot, and I'm trying to say it right, you know. Don't judge me. But anyway, we believe that one of our best resources here at Theater Folk is the Drama Teacher Academy. This is the education arm of Theater Folk, and it is just for you, just for teachers. We have professional development courses designed specifically for you. Yep, I'm talking about you, and I know that you have been through so many PD days or professional learning community events that have nothing to do with theater. And this is not like that. We have courses on classroom management for the drama classroom, teaching mask, concept-based design, devising, turning your drama class into a production classroom for advanced students, a complete Drama 1 curriculum, and more. Go to dramateacheracademy.com to see DTA in action. You can also find the link in the show notes, theaterfolk.com/episode176. Are you doing one of Theater Folk's plays? Take a rehearsal picture and send it to us. Working on a monologue in the classroom? Take a picture. Send it to us. Are you a member of the aforementioned Drama Teacher Academy and you're using an exercise? Take a 30-second video of said exercise and send it to us. We want to showcase you. We want to brag about what you do. Where do you send all this? tfolk@theaterfolk.com. And finally, where can you find this podcast? We post new episodes every second Tuesday at theaterfolk.com and on our Facebook page and Twitter. You can find us on youtube.com/theaterfolk and on the Stitcher app. You can subscribe to the Drama Teacher Podcast on iTunes. All you have to do is search for the word Theater Folk. And that's where we're going to end. Take care, my friends. Take care.